my office and was soon beside me. He was breathing so hard I thought he'd sprinted from his house a mile out in the country.
"He hit us?"
he whispered as if the sniper could hear. He was examining the broken glass. "Twice," I said, nodding up at the broken panes.
"Where is he?"
he asked as he moved a camera with a long-range lens into position. "The cupola," I said, pointing.
"Be careful. He hit that door when I opened it." "Have you seen him?"
"Male, white, with black highlights."
"Oh, one of those. Keep your head down."
We stayed huddled and crouched for several minutes. More cops scurried about, going nowhere in particular and giving the distinct impression that they were thrilled to be there, but had little idea what to do.
"Anybody hurt?"
Wiley asked, suddenly anxious that maybe he'd miss some blood.
"How am I supposed to know?"
Then more shots, very quick and startling. We peeked and saw him from the shoulders up, blazing away. Wiley focused and began taking pictures through the long-range lens. A police car had been parked three doors down from the tea shop. The sniper fired a burst at it, and when the gas tank exploded, the crisis stepped up to the next level. Thick smoke poured out from under the car. Then we saw flames. The sniper found this sporting, and for a few minutes he hit nothing but cars. I was certain my Spitfire would be irresistible, but perhaps it was too small. He lost his nerve, though, when fire was eventually returned. Two of Sheriff Coley's men stationed themselves on roofs, and when they unloaded on the cupola, the sniper ducked low and was out of business.
"I got him!"
one of the deputies shouted down to Sheriff Coley. Wiley and I waited for 20 minutes. All was quiet. More cops sprinted into the courthouse. We relaxed and sat in the rockers, but we did not take our eyes off the cupola. Big Mouth, Margaret, and Hardy joined us on the balcony. The police car burned until the fire department eventually showed up and doused it. The doors of the courthouse opened and some of the county employees came out and began smoking furiously. Then we saw a deputy in the cupola, and the town was safe again. The five of us hurried over to the courthouse, along with the rest of downtown Clanton. The third floor was sealed off. Court was not in session, so Sheriff Coley directed us to the courtroom, where he promised a quick briefing. Wiley went downstairs to sniff around. A body was about to be removed from the courthouse, and he wanted a shot of the sniper. The white hair, black face, painted stripes. There were a lot of questions. The deputy sharpshooters had evidently missed. The sniper was identified as Hank Hooten, the local lawyer who had assisted Ernie Gaddis in the prosecution of Danny Padgett. He was in custody and unharmed. When Sheriff Coley announced this in the courtroom, we were shocked and bewildered. Our nerves were pretty raw anyway, but this was too much to believe. "Mr. Hooten was found in the small stairwell that leads up to the cupola," Coley was saying, but I was too stunned to take notes. "He did not resist arrest and is now in custody."
"What was he wearing?" someone asked.
"Nothing."
"Nothing?"
"Absolutely nothing. He had what appeared to be black shoe polish on his face and chest, but other than that, he was as naked as a newborn."
"What type of weapons?" I asked.
"We found two high-powered rifles. That's all I can say right now."
"Did he say anything?"
"Not a word."
Wiley said they wrapped Hank in some sheets and shoved him in the back seat of a patrol car. He shot some photos, but was not optimistic.
"There were a dozen cops around him," he said.
2 days later, Hank Hooten was sent to the state mental hospital at Whitfield, where he would remain for several years. He was initially indicted for trying to kill half of Clanton, but with time the charges were dropped. He allegedly told Ernie Gaddis that he was not shooting at anyone in particular, didn't want to harm anyone, but was just upset because the town had failed to send Danny Padgett to his death. Word eventually drifted back to Clanton that he had been diagnosed as severely schizophrenic. Slap-ass crazy was the conclusion on the streets. Never in the history of Ford County had a person lost his mind in such a spectacular fashion. 1 year after I bought the newspaper, I sent Bibi a check for $55,000. Her loan plus interest at the rate of 10%. She had not discussed the matter of interest when she gave me the money, nor had we signed a promissory note. 10% was a bit high, and I hoped it would prompt her to send the check back. I sent it, held my breath, watched the mail, and sure enough, about a week later, there was a letter from Memphis.
Dear William, I enclose your check, which I was not expecting and have no use for at this time. If for some unlikely reason I need the money in the future, then we shall at that time discuss this matter. Your offer of payment makes me extremely proud of you and your integrity. What you have accomplished in 1 year down there is a source of great pride for me, and I delight in telling my friends about your success as a newspaper publisher and editor. I must confess that I was worried about you when you came home from Syracuse. You appeared to lack direction and motivation, and your hair was too long. You have proven me wrong, and cut your hair a little to boot. You're all I have, William, and I love you dearly. Please write me more often. Love, Bibi.
I happily tore up the check, walked down to the bank, and borrowed another $50,000 from Stanat Cabbage. Hardy had found a slightly used offset press in Atlanta, and I bought it for $108,000. We ditched our ancient letterpress and moved into the 20th century. The Times took on a new look. Much cleaner print, sharper photos, smarter designs. Our circulation was at 6,000, and I could see steady, profitable growth. The elections of 1971 certainly helped. By late February, the county was consumed with the coming August election. Sheriff Coley had two opponents, with two more threatening. The deadline to file for office was June, and he had yet to do so. This fueled speculation that he might not run. At noon on the 4th of July, the temperature was 101 degrees and the humidity felt even higher. The parade was led by the mayor, even though he was not yet running for anything. State and local elections were in 1971. The presidential race was in 1972. Judicial elections were in 1973. Municipal elections were in 1974. Mississippians loved voting almost as much as football. I watched the parade from the third-floor balcony of the security bank. Stanat Cabbage threw an annual party up there. Since I now owed the bank a sizable sum, I was invited to sip lemonade and watch the festivities. For a reason no one could remember, the Rotarians were in charge of the speeches. They had parked a long flatbed trailer next to the Confederate sentry and decorated it with bales of hay and red, white, and blue bunting. When the parade was over, the throng moved tightly around the trailer and waited anxiously. An old-fashioned courthouse hanging couldn't have drawn a more expectant audience. The first speeches were from the candidates for constable and justice of the peace. Everyone was waiting for the main event, the speeches by the candidates for sheriff. Mackie Don Coley had entered the race in late May. He had three opponents, the most popular of whom was a Clanton City policeman named T.R. Meredith. Freck Oswald was running for the fourth time. In the prior three, he had finished dead last. He appeared headed for the bottom again, but seemed to enjoy the fun of it. Trice McNatt was running for the second time. He began his remarks by saying, "I really don't give a damn about China." This was humorous, but also stupid. Swearing in public in the presence of ladies would cost him many votes. T.R. Meredith was a 30-year veteran of law enforcement. He was an awful speaker, but he was related to half the county, according to Stan. Stan knew about such things. He was related to the other half.
"Meredith will win by 1,000 votes in the runoff," he predicted. This caused quite an argument among the other guests.
Mackie Don went last. He had been the sheriff since 1943 and wanted just one more term.
"He's been saying that for 20 years, Stan said.
Coley rambled on about his experience, his knowledge of the county and its people. When he finished, the applause was polite, but certainly not encouraging. 4 weeks later, around dusk on the first Tuesday in August, much of the same crowd gathered around the courthouse to vote and enjoy the sport of a rural election. It had cooled off considerably. The temperature was only 92, with 98% humidity. The polls closed at 6, and an hour later the square was alive and wired with anticipation. Two enormous black chalkboards were placed side by side near the front door of the courthouse, and there the returns were tallied. "We have the results from North Caraway," the clerk announced into a microphone so loud it could have been heard 5 miles away. The festive mood was immediately serious.
"North Caraway's always first," Baggy said.
It was almost 8:30, almost dark. We were sitting on the porch outside my office waiting for the news. We planned to delay press time for 24 hours and publish our election special on Thursday. It took some time for the clerk to read the vote totals for every candidate for every office. Halfway through, she said, "And in the sheriff's race," several thousand people held their breath. "Mackie Dom Coley, 84. Trice McNatt, 21. T.R. Meredith, 62. And Freck Oswald, 11. A loud cheer went up on the far side of the lawn where Coley's supporters were camped.
"Coley's always tough on Caraway," Baggy said. "But he's beat."
"He's beat?" I asked. The first of 28 precincts were in, and Baggy was already predicting winners.
"Yep. For T.R. to run strong in a place where he has no base shows folks are fed up with Mackie Don. Wait till you see the Clanton boxes."
Slowly, the returns dribbled in, from places I'd never heard of. Pleasant Hill, Shady Grove, Klebe, Three Corners, Clover Hill, Green Alley, Possum Ridge, Massey Mill, Calico Ridge. Woody Gates and the Country Boys, who seemed to always be available, filled in the gaps with some bluegrass. The Pagets voted at a tiny precinct called Dancing Creek. When the clerk announced the votes from there, and Coley got 31 votes and the other three got 8 combined, there was a refreshing round of boos from the crowd. Clanton East followed, the largest precinct and the one I voted in. Coley got 285 votes, Trice 47. And when TR's total of 644 was announced, the place went wild. Baggy grabbed me and we celebrated with the rest of the town. Coley was going down without a runoff. I was quite proud of the town. In the aftermath of a brutal murder and its baffling verdict, we had rallied, fought back, and spoken clearly that we would not tolerate corruption. The strong vote against Coley was our way of hitting at the Pagets. For the second time in 100 years, they would not own the sheriff. T.R. Meredith got 61% of the vote, a stunning landslide. We printed 8,000 copies of our election edition and sold every one of them. I became a staunch believer in voting every year. Democracy at its finest. Mr. Max Hocutt died on New Year's Day, 1972. Gilma knocked on my apartment window early that morning and eventually got me to the door. I'd been asleep for less than 5 hours, and I needed a full day of hard sleep, maybe two. I followed her into the old mansion, my first visit inside in many months, and I was shocked at how badly it was deteriorating. But there were more urgent matters. We walked to the main stairway in the front foyer where Wilma joined us. She pointed a crooked and wrinkled finger upward and said, "He's up there, first door on the right. We've already been up once this morning." Once a day up the stairs was their limit. They now were in their late 70s and not far behind Mr. Max. He was lying in a large bed with a dirty white sheet pulled up to his neck. His skin was the color of the sheet. I stood beside him for a moment to make sure he wasn't breathing. I had never been called upon to pronounce someone dead, but this was not a close call. Mr. Max looked as though he'd been dead for a month. I walked back down the stairs where Wilma and Gilma were waiting right where I'd left them. They looked at me as if I might have a different diagnosis. "I'm afraid he's dead," I said.
"We know that," Gilma said. "Tell us what to do," Wilma said.
This was the first corpse I'd been called upon to process, but the next step seemed pretty obvious. "Well, perhaps we should call Mr. McGargle down at the funeral home."
"I told you so," Wilma said to Gilma.
They didn't move, so I went to the phone and called Mr. McGargle.
"It's New Year's Day,"
he said. It was apparent my call had awakened him. "He's still dead," I said.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, I'm sure. I just saw him."
"Where is he?"
"In bed. He went peacefully."
"Sometimes these old geezers are just sleeping soundly, you know."
I turned away from the twins so they wouldn't hear me argue about whether their brother was really dead. "He's not sleeping, Mr. McGargle. He's dead."
"I'll be there in an hour."
I hung up and was invited into the kitchen for a cup of instant coffee. On the counter was a box of cream of wheat and beside it a large bowl of the cereal, mixed and ready to eat. Evidently, Wilma or Gilma had prepared breakfast for their brother, and when he didn't come down, they went after him. The coffee was undrinkable until I poured in sugar. They sat across the narrow prep table, watching me curiously. Their eyes were red, but they were not crying.
"We can't live here," Wilma said,
with the finality that came from years of discussion.
"We want you to buy the place," Gilma added. "We'll sell it to you for $100,000 and move to Florida."
"Florida?" I asked.
"We have a cousin there," Wilma said. "She lives in a retirement village, and Melberta is nearby."
"Melberta?" I thought she was still around the house somewhere, sneaking through the shadows. They explained that they had placed her in a home a few months back. The home was somewhere north of Tampa. That's where they wanted to go and spend the rest of their days.
"We want you to buy the Mercedes, too,"
Wilma added. Unlike the house, the car was in mint condition. The house had 6 bedrooms, 4 floors, and a basement, 4 or 5 bathrooms, living and dining rooms, library, kitchen, wide-sweeping porches that were fallen in, and an attic that I felt certain was crammed with family treasures buried there centuries ago. It would take months just to clean it before the remodelers moved in. $100,000 was a low price for such a mansion, but there were not enough newspapers sold in the entire state to renovate the place. I had been looking at real estate, but frankly, I'd been so spoiled by paying them $50 a month that I found it hard to leave. I was 24 years old, very single, and I was having a grand time watching the money accumulate in the bank. Why would I risk financial ruin by buying that money pit? I bought it 2 days after the funeral. The contractor I hired to transform the Hocut house was Mr. Lester Klump from out in Shady Grove. He'd been highly recommended by Baggy, who, of course, knew exactly how to restore a mansion. Stanak Cabbage at the bank also recommended Mr. Klump, and since Stan held the mortgage for $100,000, I listened to him. Mr. Klump and his son, Lester Jr., spent days going over the house. They were terrified of the project, and knew it would be a regular nightmare if anybody got in a hurry, especially me. After a few days of scratching our heads and kicking at the gravel, we agreed on a plan whereby they would bill me weekly for their labor and supplies, and I would add 10% for their overhead, which I hoped meant profit. In April 1972, the project began. 5 years and 2 months after Lester Klump Sr. and Lester Klump Jr. first set foot in the Hocut house, they finished the renovation. The ordeal was over, and the results were splendid. Once I accepted their languid pace, I settled in for the long haul and worked hard selling ad copy. Only once in 5 years was I unable to pay the Klumps on time. I refused to borrow money for the project, though Stanat Cabbage was always ready to loan it. I was broke, but I didn't care. The money pit had been sealed off. I had teetered on the brink of insolvency, dodged it, and now I could begin stashing it away again. And I had something magnificent to show for the time, effort, and investment. The house had been built around 1900 by Dr. Miles Hocut. It had a distinctive Victorian style with 2 high gabled roofs in the front, a turret that ran up 4 levels, and wide covered porches that swept around the house on both sides. Inside, the heart pine floors on all 3 levels had been restored to their original beauty. Walls had been removed, rooms and hallways opened up, I added windows everywhere. The house had originally been built like a cave. Mr. Klump admitted he had never tasted champagne, but he happily chugged it down as we completed our little finishing ceremony on a side porch. I handed him what I hoped would be his last check. We shook hands, posed for a photograph by Wiley Meek, then popped the cork. Many of the rooms were bare. It would take years to properly decorate the place, and it would require the assistance of someone with far more knowledge and taste than I possessed. Half empty, though, the house was still spectacular. It needed a party. I borrowed $2,000 from Stan and ordered wine and champagne from Memphis. I found a suitable caterer from Tupelo. The only one in Clanton specialized in ribs and catfish, and I wanted something a bit classier.
The official invitation list of 300 included everybody I knew in town, and a few I did not. The unofficial list was comprised of those who'd heard me say, "We'll have a huge party when it's finished." I invited Bibi and three of her friends from Memphis. I invited my father, but he was too worried about inflation and the bond market. I invited Miss Callie and Esau, Reverend Thurston Small, three clerks from the courthouse, two school teachers, an assistant basketball coach, a teller at the bank, and the newest lawyer in town. That made a total of 11 blacks, and I would have invited more if I'd known more. I was determined to have the first integrated party in Clanton. Lucian Wilbanks arrived late and told me it was the grandest party he'd seen in Clanton in 20 years. Our new sheriff, Trice McNatt, dropped by with several of his uniformed deputies. T.R. Meredith had died of colon cancer the year before. Baggy passed out in a second-floor bedroom where I found him the next afternoon. The Stooks twins, who owned the hardware store, showed up in brand-new matching overalls. They were 70 years old, lived together, never married, and wore matching overalls every day. There was no dress requirement. The invitation said, "Open attire." The front lawn was covered with two large white tents, and at times the crowd spilled from underneath them. The party began at 1 p.m. Saturday afternoon, and would have gone past midnight if the wine and food had lasted. By 10, Woody Gates and his band were exhausted. There was nothing left to drink but a few warm beers, nothing to eat but a few tortilla chips, and nothing left to see. The house had been thoroughly seen and enjoyed. Late the next morning, I scrambled eggs for Bibi and her friends. We sat on the front porch and drank coffee and admired the mess made just hours before. It took me a week to clean up. Through the years in Clanton, I'd heard plenty of horror stories of imprisonment at the state penitentiary at Parchman. It was in sprawling farmland in the Delta, the richest farming region in the state, 2 hours west of Clanton. Living conditions were wretched. Cramped barracks that were suffocating in the summer and frigid in the winter. Ghastly food, scant medical care, a slave system, brutal sex. Forced labor, sadistic guards, the list was endless and pathetic. When I thought of Danny Padgett, which I did often, I was always comforted by the belief that he was at Parchman getting what he deserved. He was lucky he hadn't been strapped to a chair in a gas chamber. My assumption was wrong. In the late 60s, in an effort to ease the overcrowding at Parchman, the state had built two satellite prisons, or camps as they were known. The plan had been to place 1,000 nonviolent offenders in more civilized confinement. They would obtain job training, even qualify for work release. One such satellite was near the small town of Broomfield, 3 hours south of Clanton. Judge Lupus died in 1972. During the Padgett trial, his stenographer had been a homely young woman named Darla Claybo. She worked for Lupus for a few years and after his death left the area. When she walked into my office late one afternoon in the summer of 1977, I knew I had seen her somewhere in the distant past. Darla introduced herself and I quickly remembered where I'd seen her. For 5 straight days during the Padgett trial, she had sat below the bench next to the exhibit table, taking down every word. She was now living in Alabama and had driven 5 hours to tell me something. First, she swore me to absolute secrecy. Her hometown was Broomfield. 2 weeks earlier, she had been visiting her mother when she saw a familiar face walking down the sidewalk around lunchtime. It was Danny Padgett, strolling along with a buddy. She was so startled she tripped on the edge of a curb and almost fell into the street. They walked into a local diner and sat down for lunch. Darla saw them through a window and decided not to go in. There was a chance Padgett might recognize her, though she wasn't sure why that frightened her. The man with him wore the uniform that was common in Broomfield, navy slacks, short-sleeved white shirt with the words, "Broomfield Correctional Facility," in very small letters over the pocket. He also wore black cowboy boots and no gun whatsoever. She explained that some of the guards who handled the prisoners on work release had the option of carrying a weapon. It was hard to imagine a white man in Mississippi voluntarily declining to carry a gun if given the option, but she suspected that perhaps Danny didn't want his own personal guard to be armed. Danny was wearing white dungarees and a white shirt, possibly issued by the camp. The two enjoyed a long lunch and appeared to be good friends. From her car, Darla watched them leave the diner. She followed from a distance as they took a leisurely stroll for a few blocks until Danny entered a building that housed the regional office of the Mississippi Highway Department. The guard got into a camp vehicle and drove away. The following morning, Darla's mother entered the building under the pretext of filing a complaint about a road in need of repair. She was rudely informed that no such procedure existed, and in the ensuing brouhaha managed to catch a glimpse of the young man Darla had carefully described. He was holding a clipboard and appeared to be just another useless pencil pusher. Darla's mother had a friend whose son worked as a clerk at the Broomfield camp. He confirmed that Danny Pageant had been moved there in the summer of 1974. When she finished with the story, she said, "Are you going to expose him?" I was reeling, but I could already see the story. "I will investigate," I said. "Depends on what I find."
"Please do. This ain't right."
"It's unbelievable," I agreed. She swore me to secrecy again and left her address. She wanted a copy of the paper if we did the story. At 6 the next morning, I had no trouble jumping out of bed. Wiley and I drove to Broomfield. Since both the Spitfire and the Mercedes were likely to draw attention in any small town in Mississippi, we took his Ford pickup. We easily found the camp, 3 miles out of town. We found the Highway Department office building. At noon, we took our positions along Main Street. Since Paget would certainly recognize either one of us, we faced the challenge of trying to hide on a busy street in a strange town without acting suspicious. Wiley sat low in his truck, camera loaded and ready. I hid behind a newspaper on a bench. There was no sign of him the first day. We drove back to Clanton, then early the next morning left again for Broomfield. At 11:30, a prison vehicle stopped in front of the office building. The guard went inside, collected his prisoner, and they walked to lunch. On July 17, 1977, our front page had 4 large photos. One of Danny walking along the sidewalk sharing a laugh with the guard, one of them as they entered the city grill, one of the office building, one of the gate to the Broomfield camp. My headline howled, "No prison for Paget. He's off at camp." My report began. 4 years after being convicted of the brutal rape and murder of Rhoda Castle Law and being sentenced to life in the state penitentiary at Parchman, Danny Paget was moved to the state's new satellite camp at Broomfield. After 3 years there, he enjoys all the perks of a well-connected inmate, an office job with the state highway department, his own personal guard, and long lunches, cheeseburgers and milkshakes in local cafes where the other patrons have never heard of him or his crimes. The story was as venomous and slanted as I could possibly make it. The reaction in Clanton was mixed. Many of those who called or stopped me on the street were angry and wanted something done. A few seemed indifferent and wanted to forget Paget altogether. He was old news. And among some, there was a frustrating, almost cynical lack of surprise. They figured the Paget had worked their magic once more, found the right pockets, pulled the right strings. Harry Rex was in this camp.
"What's the big fuss, boy? They've bought governors before."
The photo of Danny walking down the street free as a bird frightened Miss Callie considerably.
"She didn't sleep last night," Esau mumbled to me when I arrived for lunch that Thursday. "I wish you hadn't found him."
Fortunately, the Memphis and Jackson newspapers picked up the story, and it took on a life of its own. They turned up the heat to a point where the politicians had to get involved. The governor and the attorney general were soon jockeying to lead the parade to get the boy sent back to Parchman. 2 weeks after I broke the story, Danny Paget was reassigned to the state penitentiary. The next day, I received 2 phone calls, one at the office, one at home while I was asleep. Different voices, but with the same message. I was a dead man. I notified the FBI in Oxford, and 2 agents visited me in Clanton. I leaked this to a reporter in Memphis, and soon the town knew that I'd been threatened and that the FBI was investigating. For a month, Sheriff McNatt kept a patrol car in front of my office around the clock. Another one sat in my driveway during the night. After a 7-year hiatus, I was carrying a gun again. There was no immediate bloodshed. The threats were not forgotten, but as time passed, they became less ominous. I never stopped carrying a gun. It was always within reach, but I lost interest in it. I found it hard to believe that the Paget would risk the severe backlash that would come if they knocked off the editor of the local paper. Even if the town was not entirely enamored of me, as opposed to someone as beloved as Mr. Caudle, the uproar would create more pressure than the Pagets were willing to risk. They kept to themselves like never before. After the defeat of Mackie Don Coley in 1971, they once again proved quite adept at changing tactics. Danny had given them enough unwanted attention. They were determined to avoid any more. They retrenched even deeper into Paget Island. They increased security in the wasted belief that the next sheriff, T.R. Meredith, or his successor, Trice McNatt, might come after them. They grew their crops and smuggled them off the island in planes, boats, pickups, and flatbed trucks, ostensibly loaded with timber. With typical Paget shrewdness, and sensing that the marijuana business might become too risky, they began pumping money into legitimate enterprises. They bought a highway contracting company and quickly turned it into a reliable bidder for government projects. They bought an asphalt plant, a ready-mix concrete plant, and gravel pits around the northern part of the state. Highway construction was a notably corrupt business in Mississippi, and the Pagets knew how to play the game. Few people in Clanton did not attend church. Those who did seemed to know exactly which ones did not. And there was a common invitation to come worship with us. The farewell, see you on Sunday, was almost as common as y'all come see us. I got hammered with these invitations during my first years in town. Once it was known that the owner and editor of the Times did not go to church, I became the most famous derelict in town. I decided to do something about it. Each week, Margaret put together our religion page, which included a rather extensive menu of churches arranged by denominations. There were also a few ads by the more affluent congregations, and notices for revivals, reunions, potluck suppers, and countless other activities. Working from this page and from the phone book, I made a list of all the churches in Ford County. The total was 88, but it was a moving target since congregations were always splitting, folding here and popping up over there. My goal was to visit each one of them, something I was sure had never been done, and a feat that would put me in a class by myself among churchgoers. I began my epic adventure in 1974. The first church I visited was the Calvary Full Gospel, a rowdy Pentecostal assemblage on a gravel road 2 miles out of town. I wrote a pleasant little report about my visit and ran it on the religion page. I commented on the warm atmosphere of the church, the lovely solo by Miss Helen Hatcher, the powerful sermon by Preacher Bob, and so on. Needless to say, this proved to be very popular. At least twice a month, I went to church. I sat with Miss Callie and Esau and listened to the Reverend Thurston Small preach for 2 hours and 12 minutes. I sat with Margaret at the First Baptist Church in Clanton and listened to Reverend Millard Stark give his annual sermon on the sins of alcohol. With bad timing, I had a hangover that morning, and Stark kept looking at me. On my list, number 64, was the Calico Ridge Independent Church, located deep in the hills in the northeastern part of the county. Late in the service, I caught a glimpse of a face I'd seen before. Thin, pale, gaunt, topped with grayish hair. I couldn't place it, but I knew it was familiar. The man was seated in the second row from the front, on the other side of the small sanctuary, and he seemed out of touch with the worship service. At times he appeared to be praying. Then he would sit while everyone else was standing. Those around him seemed to accept him and ignore him at the same time. He turned once and looked directly at me. It was Hank Hooten, the ex-lawyer who'd shot up the town in 1971. He'd been taken in a straitjacket to the state mental hospital, and a few years later there'd been a rumor that he'd been released. No one had seen him, though. For 2 days after that, I tried to track down Hank Hooten. My calls to the state mental hospital went nowhere. Hank had a brother in Shady Grove, but he refused to talk. I snooped around Calico Ridge, but typically, no one there would utter a word to a stranger like me. One Sunday night, I was out drinking with Harry Rex, and afterward, we were in no condition to drive. I walked to my office and slept on the sofa. I was there snoring off the tequila when the phone rang after midnight. It was a reporter I knew from the Big Daily in Memphis.
"Are you covering the parole hearing tomorrow?"
he asked. "Tomorrow," I mumbled. "Monday, September the 18th," he said slowly. I was reasonably certain the year was 1978. "What parole hearing?" I asked, trying desperately to wake myself up and put two thoughts together.
"Well, Danny Padgett's. You don't know about it?"
"Hell no."
"It's scheduled for 10 a.m. at Parchman. I just found out. Evidently, they don't advertise these."
I sat in the darkness for a long time, cursing once again the backwardness of a state that conducted such important matters in such ridiculous ways. How could parole even be considered for Danny Padgett? 8 years had passed since the murder and his conviction. He had received two life sentences of at least 10 years each. We assumed that meant a minimum of 20 years. I drove home around 3 a.m., slept fitfully for 2 hours, then woke up Harry Rex, who was in no condition to be dealt with. I picked up sausage biscuits and strong coffee, and we met at his office around 7. We were both ill-tempered, and as we plowed through his law books, there were sharp words and foul language, not aimed at each other, but at the blurry and toothless parole system passed by the legislature 30 years earlier. Somewhere between the judicial system, the penal system, and the parole system, Danny Padgett's 2 consecutive life terms had been changed to 2 concurrent sentences. They ran side by side, Harry Rex tried to explain. I shook my head in disapproval again, and this irritated him. I finally got Sheriff Trice McNatt to answer the phone. He sounded as hungover as we were, though he was a strict teetotaler. McNatt knew nothing about the parole hearing. I asked him if he planned to attend, but his day was already filled with important meetings. I would have called Judge Lupus, but he'd been dead for 6 years. Ernie Gaddis had retired and was fishing in the Smoky Mountains. His successor, Rufus Buckley, lived in Tyler County, and his phone number was unlisted. At 8 o'clock, I jumped in my car with a biscuit and a cup of cold coffee. An hour west of Ford County, the land flattened dramatically, and the Delta began. It was a region rich in farming and poor in living conditions, but I was in no mood to take in the sights and offer social commentary. I was too nervous about crashing a clandestine parole hearing. I was also nervous about setting foot inside Parchman, a legendary hellhole. After 2 hours, I saw fences next to fields, then razor wire. Soon there was a sign, and I turned into the main gate. I informed the guard in the booth that I was a reporter, therefore a parole hearing.
"Straight ahead, left at the second building," he said helpfully as he wrote down my name.
There was a cluster of buildings close to the highway and a row of white frame houses that would fit on any Maple Street in Mississippi. I chose the Admin A building and sprinted inside, looking for the first secretary. I found her, and she sent me to the next building, second floor. It was just about 10. There were people at the end of the hallway loitering outside a room. One was a prison guard, one was a state trooper, one wore a wrinkled suit.
"I'm here for a parole hearing," I announced.
"In there," the guard said, pointing.
Without knocking, I yanked open the door, as any intrepid reporter would, and stepped inside. Things had just been called to order, and my presence there was certainly not anticipated. There were 5 members of the parole board, and they were seated behind a slightly elevated table with their nameplates in front of them. Along one wall, another table held the Padgett crowd. Danny, his father, his mother, an uncle, and Lucian Wilbanks. Opposite them, behind another table, were various clerks and functionaries of the board and the prison. Everyone stared at me as I stormed in. My eyes locked onto Danny Padgett's, and for a second both of us managed to convey the contempt we felt for the other.
"Can I help you?" a large, badly dressed old boy growled from the center of the board. His name was Barrett Ray Jeter, the chairman. Like the other 4, he'd been appointed by the governor as a reward for vote gathering.
"I'm here for the Padgett hearing," I said.
He's a reporter.
Lucian practically yelled as he was standing. For a second, I thought I might get arrested on the spot and be carried deeper into the prison for a life sentence.
For who? Jeter demanded.
The Ford County Times, I said.
Your name?
Willie Traynor. I was glaring at Lucian, and he was scowling at me.
This is a closed hearing, Mr. Traynor, Jeter said.
Who has the right to attend? I asked.
The parole board, the parolee, his family, his witnesses, his lawyer, and any witnesses for the other side.
By process of elimination, I quickly deduced that I had to become a witness if I wanted to watch the show. I said as loudly and clearly as possible,
Well, since there's no one else here from Ford County in opposition, I'm a witness. You can't be a reporter and a witness, Jeter said. Where is that written in the Mississippi Code?
I asked, waving my copies from Harry Rex's law books.
Jeter nodded at a young man in a dark suit.
I'm the attorney for the parole board, he said politely. You can testify in this hearing, Mr. Traynor, but you cannot report it. I plan to fully report every detail of the hearing, then hide behind the First Amendment.
So be it, I said. You guys make the rules.
In less than 1 minute, the lines had been drawn. I was on one side. Everybody else was on the other.
Let's proceed, Jeter said, and I took a seat with a handful of other spectators.
The attorney for the parole board passed out a report. He recited the basics of the Paget sentence and was careful not to use the words consecutive or concurrent. Based on the inmate's exemplary record during his incarceration, he had qualified for good time, a vague concept created by the parole system and not by the state legislature. Subtracting the time the inmate spent in the county jail awaiting trial, he was now eligible for parole. When it came my turn to speak, I had no idea what to say, so I just jumped into an extremely graphic description of the rape and the murder. I unloaded everything I could possibly remember, and I put special emphasis on the fact that the two children witnessed some or all of the attack. And when Danny Paget had finished testifying, I concluded, instead of returning to his seat, he walked to the jury box, shook his finger in the faces of the jurors, and said, You convict me, and I'll get every damned one of you. A board member named Mr. Horace Adler jerked upright in his seat and blurted toward the Pagets, Is that true? It's in the record, I said quickly before Lucian had the chance to lie again. He was slowly getting to his feet.
Is that true, Mr. Wilbanks? Adler insisted.
He threatened the jury? Asked another board member.
I have the transcript, I said. I'll be happy to send it to you.
Is that true? Adler asked for the third time.
There were 300 people in the courtroom, I said, staring at Lucian and saying with my eyes, Don't do it. Don't lie about it.
Shut up, Mr. Traynor, a board member said. It's in the record, I said again. That's enough, Jeter shouted.
Lucian was standing and trying to think of a response. Everyone was waiting. Finally,
I don't remember everything that was said, he began, and I snorted as loudly as possible. Anything else, Mr. Traynor? Jeter asked.
Yes. I hope this board will not make a mockery out of our system and let this man go free after 8 years. He's lucky to be sitting here instead of on death row where he belongs.
I sat down and fumed. I glared at Lucian Wilbanks and decided that I would work diligently to hate him for the rest of either his life or mine, whichever ended first. Jeter announced a brief recess, and I assumed they needed time to regroup in a back room and count their money. Perhaps Mr. Paget could be summoned to provide some extra cash for a board member or two. To irritate the board attorney, I scribbled pages of notes for the report he'd prohibited me from writing. We waited 30 minutes before they filed back in, everyone looking guilty of something. Jeter called for a vote. 2 voted in favor of parole, 2 against, 1 abstained.
Parole is denied at this time, Jeter announced, and Mrs. Paget burst into tears.
She hugged Danny before they took him away. The parole hearing was front page news in the Ford County Times.
I loaded the report with every detail I could remember, and on page 5 let loose with a blistering editorial about the process. I sent a copy to each member of the parole board and to its attorney, and because I was so worked up, every member of the state legislature, the attorney general, the lieutenant governor, and the governor received a complimentary copy. Most ignored it, but the attorney for the parole board did not. He wrote me a lengthy letter in which he said he was deeply concerned about my willful violation of parole board procedures. He was pondering a session with the attorney general in which they would evaluate the gravity of my actions and possibly pursue action that would lead to far-reaching consequences. My lawyer, Harry Rex, had assured me the parole board's policy of secret meetings was patently unconstitutional, in clear violation of the First Amendment, and he would happily defend me in federal court, for a reduced hourly rate, of course. I swapped heated letters with the board's lawyer for a month before he seemed to lose interest in pursuing me. Number 78 on my list of churches to visit, the Maranatha Primitive Baptist Church, was a little jewel at the foot of a hill next to a creek, under a cluster of pin oaks that were at least 200 years old. It was a small white frame building, narrow and long, with a high-pitched tin roof and a red steeple that was so tall it got lost in the oaks. The front doors were open wide, beckoning any and all to come worship. I eased into the back pew, my usual place, and sat next to a well-dressed gentleman who'd been around for as long as the church. I counted 56 other worshipers that morning. The pastor was a jovial man named J.B. Cooper. Pastor Cooper gazed upon his flock and realized I was the only visitor. He called my name, welcomed me, and made some harmless crack about getting favorable coverage in the Times. After 4 years of touring and 77 rather generous and colorful church notes, it was impossible for me to sneak into a service without getting noticed. As I was leaving the building, I saw a man in a wheelchair being pushed down the handicap ramp. It was a face I'd seen before, and I walked over to say hello. Lenny Farguson, the crippled boy, juror number 7 or 8, had evidently taken a turn for the worse. During the trial in 1970, he'd been able to walk, though it was not a pretty thing to behold. Now he was in a chair. His father introduced himself. His mother was in a cluster of ladies finishing up one last round of goodbyes.
"Got a minute?"
Farguson asked. In Mississippi, that question really meant, "We need to talk, and it might take a while." I sat on a bench under one of the oaks. His father rolled him over, then left us to talk.
"I see your paper every week," he said. "You think Padgett will get out?"
"Sure. It's just a question of when. He can apply for parole once a year, every year."
"Will he come back here, to Ford County?"
I shrugged because I had no idea. "Probably. The Padgetts stick close to their land." He considered this for some time. He was gaunt and hunched over like an old man. If my memory was correct, he was about 25 at the time of the trial. We were roughly about the same age, though he looked twice as old. I had heard the story of his affliction, some injury in a sawmill. "Does that frighten you?" I asked. He smiled and said,
"Nothing frightens me, Mr. Traynor. The Lord is my shepherd."
He paused.
"Will you be there when he's released?"
"I'd like to be," I said, "but I'm not sure how it's done."
"Will you call me when you know he's out?"
"Of course." The front office of the Times was seldom attended. There were some tables with copies of the current edition strewn about. There was a counter that Margaret sometimes used to lay out ads. The bell on the front door rang all day long as people came and went. About once a week, a stranger would venture upstairs where my office door was usually open. More often than not, it was some grieving relative there to discuss an upcoming obituary. I looked up one afternoon in March 1979, and there was a gentleman in a nice suit standing at my office door. Unlike Harry Rex, whose entrance began on the street and was heard by everyone in the building, this guy had climbed the stairs without making a sound. His name was Gary McGrew, a consultant from Nashville, whose area of expertise was small-town newspapers. As I fixed a pot of coffee, he explained that a rather well-financed client of his was planning to buy several newspapers in Mississippi during 1979. Because I had 7,000 subscribers, no debt, an offset press, and because we now ran the printing for 6 smaller weeklies, plus our own shopper's guides, his client was very interested in buying the Ford County Times.
How interested? I asked.
Extremely. If we could look at the books, we could value your company. He left and I made a few phone calls to verify his credibility. He checked out fine, and I collected my current financials. 3 days later, we met again, this time at night. I did not want Wiley or Baggy or anyone else hanging around. News that the Times was changing hands would be such hot gossip that they'd open the coffee shops at 3 a.m. instead of 5. McGrew crunched the numbers like a seasoned analyst. I waited, oddly nervous, as if the verdict might drastically change my life. You're clearing $100,000 after taxes, plus you're taking a salary of $50,000. Depreciation is another 20, no interest because you have no debt. That's 170 in cash flow, times the standard multiple of 6, comes to 1,020,000. And the building? I asked. He glanced around as if the ceiling might collapse any moment. These places typically don't sell for much. 100,000, I said. Okay. And 100,000 for the offset press and other equipment? The total value is somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.2 million.
Is that an offer?
I asked, even more anxious. It might be. I'll have to discuss it with my client. I had no intention of selling the Times. I had stumbled into the business, gotten a few lucky breaks, worked hard writing stories and obituaries and selling pages of ads, and now, 9 years later, my little company was worth over $1 million. I was young, still single, though I was tired of being lonely and living alone in a mansion with 3 leftover Hokut cats that refused to die. I had accepted the reality that I would not find a bride in Ford County. All the good ones were snatched up by their 20th birthday, and I was too old to compete at that level. I dated all the young divorcees, most of whom were quick to hop in the sack and wake up in my fine home and dream about spending all the money I was rumored to be making. The only one I really liked, and dated off and on for a year, was saddled with 3 small children. But it's funny what $1 million will do to you. Once it was in play, it was never far from my thoughts. The job became more tedious. I grew to resent the ridiculous obituaries and the endless pressure of the deadlines. I told myself at least once a day that I no longer had to hustle the street selling ads. I could quit the editorials. A week later, I told Gary McGrew that the Times was not for sale. He said his client had decided to buy 3 papers by the end of the year, so I had time to think about it. Remarkably, word of our discussions never leaked. On a Thursday afternoon in early May, I received a phone call from the attorney for the parole board. The next Paget hearing would take place the following Monday. Convenient timing, I said. Why is that? He asked. We publish every Wednesday, so I don't have time to run a story before the hearing. We don't monitor your paper, Mr. Traynor, he said. Besides, the board has decided that you will not be permitted to attend the hearing. You violated our rules last time by reporting on what happened. I'm banned? That's correct. I'll be there anyway. I hung up and called Sheriff McNatt. He, too, had been notified of the hearing, but wasn't sure if he could attend. For fun, I asked Baggy to go. He gasped, then quickly let loose with an impressive list of excuses. I walked over to Harry Rex with the news. He had an ugly divorce trial starting Monday in Tupelo. Otherwise, he might have gone with me to Parchman. The boy's going to be released, Willie, he said. We stopped it last year, I said.
Once the parole hearings start, it's just a matter of time.
But somebody has to fight it.
Why bother? He's getting out eventually. Why piss off the Pagets? You won't get any volunteers.
Volunteers were indeed hard to find as the entire town ducked for cover. I had envisioned an angry mob packing into the parole board hearing and disrupting the meeting. My angry mob consisted of 3 people. Wiley Meek agreed to ride over with me,
though he had no interest in speaking. If they were serious about banning me from the room, Wiley would sit through it and give me the details. Sheriff McNatt surprised us with his presence. Security was tight in the hall outside the hearing room. When the board attorney saw me, he became angry and we exchanged words. Guards in uniform surrounded me. I was outnumbered and unarmed. I was escorted from the building and placed in my car, then watched by two thick-necked ruffians with low IQs. According to Wiley, the hearing went like clockwork. Lucian was there with various pageants. The board attorney read a staff report that made Danny sound like an Eagle Scout. His caseworker seconded the nomination. Lucian spoke for 10 minutes, the usual lawyerly bullshit. Danny's father spoke last and pleaded emotionally for his son's release. He was desperately needed back home, where the family had interest in timber, gravel, asphalt, trucking, contracting, and freight. He would have so many jobs and work so many hours each week that he couldn't possibly get into more trouble. Sheriff McNatt gamely stood up for the people of Ford County. He was nervous and not a good speaker, but did a credible job of replaying the crime. Remarkably, he neglected to remind the board members that a jury drawn from the same pool of people who elected him had been threatened by Danny Padgett. By a vote of 4-1, Danny Padgett was paroled from prison. Clanton was quietly disappointed. During the trial, the town had a real thirst for blood and was bitter when the jury didn't deliver the death penalty. But 9 years had passed, and since the parole hearing, it had been accepted that Danny Padgett would eventually get out. No one expected it so soon. But after the hearing, we were over the shock. Folks talked about the release, but not for long and not very loudly. Just when I had stopped dreaming of an early retirement, of cashing in, walking away, jetting off to Europe, and backpacking across Australia, just when I had resettled into my routine of covering stories and writing obits and hawking ads to every merchant in town, Mr. Gary McGrew re-entered my life, and he brought his client with him. Ray Noble was one of three principals in a company that already owned 30 weekly newspapers in the Deep South and wanted to add more. Like my college friend Nick Diener, he had been raised in the family newspaper business and could talk the talk. He swore me to secrecy, then laid out his plan. His company wanted to buy the Times, along with the papers in Tyler and Van Buren counties. They would sell off the equipment in the other two and do all the printing in Clanton because we had a better press. They would consolidate the accounting and much of the ad sales. Their offer of $1.2 million had been at the high end of the appraisal. Now they were offering $1.3 million. Cash.
After capital gains, you'll walk away with a cool million, Noble said.
I can do the math, I said, as if I'd close such deals on a weekly basis. The words cool million were rumbling through my entire body. They pressed a little. Offers were on the table for the other two papers, and I got the impression that the deal wasn't exactly coming together as they wished. The key element was the Times. We had better equipment and a slightly larger circulation. I declined again, and they left. All three of us knew it was not our last conversation. 11 years after he fled Ford County, Sam Ruffin returned in much the same manner as he left. On a bus in the middle of the night. He'd been home for 2 days before I knew it. I arrived for my Thursday lunch, and there sat Sam, rocking on the porch with a smile as wide as his mother's. Sam now had one college degree under his belt and was planning on law school. He intended to stay in Clanton for a few days, very close to home, venturing out of Lowtown only at night. I promised to talk to Harry Rex, to fish around and see what I could learn about Trooper Durant and his sons. From the legal notices we printed, I knew that Durant had remarried, then divorced for the second time. Sam wanted to see the town, so late that afternoon I picked him up in my Spitfire. Hiding under a Detroit Tigers baseball cap, he took in the sights of the small town he still called home. As I dropped him off in front of the Ruffin home, he said, "Is Padgett really out of prison?" "No one's seen him," I said, "but I'm sure he's back home."
"Do you expect trouble?"
"No, not really."
"Neither do I, but I can't convince Mama."
"Nothing will happen, Sam." The single shot that killed Lenny Farguson was fired from a .30-06 hunting rifle. The killer could have been as far as 200 yards away from the front porch where Lenny died. Thick woods began just beyond the wide lawn around the house, and there was a good chance whoever pulled the trigger had climbed a tree and had a perfectly concealed view of poor Lenny. No one heard the shot. Lenny was sitting on the porch in his wheelchair reading one of the many books he borrowed each week from the Clanton Library. His father was delivering mail. His mother was shopping at Bargain City. In all likelihood, Lenny felt no pain and died instantly. The bullet entered the right side of his head, just over the jaw, and created a massive exit wound above his left ear. When his mother found him, he'd been dead for some time. She somehow managed to control herself and refrain from touching his body or the scene. Blood was all over the porch, even dripping onto the front steps. Wiley heard the report on his police scanner. He called me with a chilling announcement.
It has begun. Farguson, the crippled boy, is dead.
Wiley swung by the office. I jumped in his pickup, and we were off to the crime scene. Neither of us said a word, but we were thinking the same thing. Lenny was still on the porch. The shot had knocked him out of his wheelchair, and he lay on his side with his face toward the house. Sheriff McNatt asked us not to take photos, and we readily complied. The paper would not have used them anyway. When the body was finally loaded onto a gurney and placed in an ambulance, Sheriff McNatt came over and leaned on the pickup next to me.
"Are you thinking what I'm thinking?" he said.
"Yep."
"Can you find me a list of the jurors?"
Though we had never printed the names of the jurors, I had the information in an old file.
"Sure," I said. "How long will it take you?"
he asked. "Give me an hour. What's your plan?"
"We got to notify those folks."
I took the list to the sheriff's office, and we looked over it together. In 1977, I had written the obituary for juror number 5, Mr. Fred Bilroy, a retired forest ranger who died suddenly of pneumonia. As far as I knew, the other 10 were still alive. McNatt gave the list to 3 of his deputies. They dispersed to deliver news that no one wanted to hear. I volunteered to tell Callie Ruffin. She was on the porch, watching Esau and Sam wage war over a game of checkers. They were delighted to see me, but the mood quickly changed. "I have some disturbing news, Miss Callie," I said somberly. They waited. "Lenny Farguson, that crippled boy on the jury with you, was murdered this afternoon." She covered her mouth and fell into her rocker. Sam steadied her, then patted her shoulder. I gave a brief description of what happened.
"He was such a good Christian boy," Miss Callie said. "We prayed together before we began deliberating."
She wasn't crying, but she was on the verge. Esau went to fetch her blood pressure pill. Ned Ray Zook owned 4,000 acres in the eastern part of the county. He farmed cotton and soybeans, and his operations were large enough to maintain sufficient profits. He was rumored to be one of the few remaining farmers who made good money from the soil. Sometime during the early hours of June 14th, a vandal entered Zook's vast equipment shed and partially drained the oil from the engines of 2 of his big tractors. The oil was collected in cans and hidden among the supplies, so when the operators arrived around 6 a.m. for the day's work, there was no sign of foul play. One operator checked the oil as he was supposed to do, saw the shortage, thought it odd, said nothing, and added 4 quarts. The other operator had checked his the afternoon before, as was his habit. The second tractor ground to a sudden halt an hour later as its engine locked up. Its operator hiked half a mile back to the shed and reported the breakdown to the farm manager.